at the end of your life? What will be your legacy? What will you leave behind for future generations? For the world? Join the world messenger, Isabella Lundberg. Each week as she brings you a new distinguished guest from the business, sports, or entertainment world to share their success, their struggles, and their lessons. They will share their insights into current hot topics that affect everyone. Isabella facilitates an intimate, vulnerable environment to find the true value of humanity and real leadership. Are you ready for your legacy? The legacy that matters?
Welcome to new season of Legacy Leader Show, your go-to podcast for expert insights on leadership and strategy in a specifically rapidly evolving world. Today, we are super thrilled to dive into geopolitics and transformative role of technology that is shaping right now our future with all the complexities that everybody's facing. We're super thrilled to have a Dr. Jake Soteriadis with us, the mastermind in strategy foresight, and someone who is absolutely not only the beacon of knowledge and expertise into obviously geopolitics and technology innovation and so much more. Obviously, his career is spanning from wide range of advising of the prime ministers shaping the strategic initiatives with U.S. State Department, but also expertise that really give us premise of what is coming and what we should be paying attention. So fasten seatbelts and let's take a quick ride here to see what future of global strategy really looks like and what should we pay attention to. Jake, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Likewise. First of all, before we dive into, I'm just curious how someone becomes such an amazing expert and which trajectory and span with career that you have in such a short period of time.
Well, first of all, let me say Happy New Year to you and to everybody that's listening and watching to us. And thanks for the question. First of all, you're very kind. I like to look at knowledge and expertise as a never-ending journey. And so, when we call somebody an expert, we assume that, you know, they've had some experience and they've done some interesting things and maybe achieved some degrees, but it's really this journey that continues. And so we never stop learning, you know, as the ancient Greeks told us. In my case, I was very fortunate that from a very young age, I really loved history. And so I started reading a lot of history. I really was developing an interest in what later would become geopolitics and strategic foresight and futurism. And I had the opportunity to travel at a young age and to do an exchange year while I was still in high school in Germany. Getting exposure to new cultures and languages and understanding what it means to be a global citizen, which then made me really appreciate, you know, my own country, the United States, even more, and understanding how the world fits together. And throughout my career in the United States military as an Air Force intelligence officer, I had the opportunity to do that because I was largely responsible for building analyses and making assessments for, you know, which geopolitical developments might happen, how all of the interconnectedness in the world, looking mostly at national security, is going to affect the trajectory of the United States. What's the role of the United States in the world? And then through that experience, I had the opportunity to pursue many educational opportunities. And I think the most important one was developing my skills as someone who practices strategic foresight as a futurist, understanding how to use the lessons of history to start doing projections and understand how the future can transpire to really look at things holistically and not in a short-sighted way. So that really was my trajectory, you know, spending time in the American intelligence community, teaching at the American Intelligence Community's university, where we educate our spies, soldiers, and diplomats, teaching at the Foreign Service Institute, which is where the State Department educates its diplomats. So I feel like I have a unique vantage point from the intelligence community, State Department, and Department of Defense to understand how all of those pieces fit together and then how we can build analyses and assessments for what's happening in the world. And by the way, 2025 is already setting us up to be a fascinating year of geopolitical developments.
Thank you for sharing a little bit more about your background. And obviously, I'm so glad for everybody watching and listening that have a chance, opportunity to look at things, as you said, from holistic perspective. And a lot of the lessons, for sure, we can learn from history, but also changes that we're seeing on the geographic front and so much that occurred in recent time. So speaking of that, obviously looking from that current landscape, do you mind sharing a little bit about your experience? How did, what shifts do you see happening right now as we exit 2024? And what do you see as a forefront that we definitely need to pay attention?
So we'll just take this from a few bookends. Number one, I think, you know, the biggest shift in 2025 is the fact that we're going to have a new American administration. President Trump is coming in. He's coming in off of a big victory in which he won over 300 electoral votes. This victory, I think, for the United States and the world is important because the United States now has a very unified government with a clear mandate to execute specific policy directions, which is many people criticize and say that, you know, President Trump and America First will maybe make the United States retrench. I think that's actually not the case. I think the United States is going to be very involved, very engaged in the world, but perhaps in a different way than we've seen previous administrations. So that's the biggest, I think, change. That's the biggest change that we're going to see. But we're also living in a period of geopolitical fluctuation because the world is reorienting itself right now. If you look at what's happened since the end of the Cold War, since the early 1990s until now, you've seen this shift, which is the United States being the only superpower in the world, where it was managing that moment, that unipolar moment in the 1990s, to where now the United States has come out of two decades of, I think, probably, you know, very, very misguided policy in the Middle East, where we saw the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan take a lot of blood and treasure from the United States. And we've seen the rise of other powers like China. The U.S.-China contest is going to be the biggest geopolitical driver of change. But wrapped up in that is also this rise of China and Russia getting closer together, countries like Iran joining that that axis of resistance or whatever we're going to call it. North Korea getting involved now in the Ukraine war, the fact that we have in Ukraine the biggest conflict in Europe since World War II raging with, frankly, you know, no end in sight yet. There's discussions that obviously President Trump and his team may be able to negotiate and, you know, an end to this conflict. We don't know how quickly that's going to happen. We don't know which concessions or which negotiations are going to happen there. So how this situation plays out is very, very important because it's going to set the stage for the next 10, 15, 20 years of geopolitical developments in Europe. How the relationship between the US and China continues is going to drive that competition greatly when we think about what's happening with Russia, what's happening with Europe, how the Ukraine war ends, what kind of guarantees are left in place. The Europeans, I think, have to take a much bigger role and make much bigger investments in their own defense. I think that's very, very clear thus far that the status quo is no longer adequate. So that's something that's very important. But also the other contest that I would underscore very, very important over the next 5, 10, 15 years is going to be the contest for rare earth minerals. Because as we move towards this energy transition, largely in the United States and the West, but more globally, we're going to see a higher demand for, you know, rare earth minerals that are going to drive this transition, things that help us create, you know, electric vehicle batteries, things that, you know, make cell phones, chips for semiconductors, all of these kinds of materials that are largely controlled by competitors like Russia and China in places like Africa. So this is, I think, a large part of the competition that we're going to see characterize the future. And you may even see rare earth minerals being referred to as, you know, the new fossil fuel competition of the 21st century.
Wow, that is a lot to unpack there, but it's such a great overview. And thank you for giving us insight. And I'm glad you mentioned Africa because we're seeing a race to Africa right now from all of different parties that are involved to try to tap into those precious resources that you were speaking of. And that are also in very high demand. But in addition to that, we obviously seek tremendous opportunity for leadership to step in and position better. So what are some opportunities that you believe that can really help with these tensions that we're seeing right now geopolitically, and then also offer that more unified front and opportunity to, as you said, find some reconciliations and opportunity to really pave that path for the next 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, okay, I would say, first of all, let's address areas of potential cooperation, which would be if we look at the U.S.-China relationship right now, we're in a period where things could get very, very dangerous moving forward because there's so much at stake. You know, the only country right now in the world that really can be a peer competitor of the United States is China. When you look at the Chinese economy, when you look at the Chinese military, when you look at that national security ecosystem in China and China's role in the global economy. China also has a lot of problems right now that we need to look at too. And these are going to become issues moving forward for the Chinese regime. When you look at population issues, when you look at housing issues, when you look at you know, the fact that foreign direct investment in China has fallen by a huge amount, you know, over 25% less in the winter of 2023 than we've seen in previous years. You know, these are signals that this competition between the US and China is really heating up. At the same time, the Chinese automotive industry is surging forward. And this is a problem about, you know, the Europeans going to allow Chinese electric vehicles in Europe, because this would be a huge source of tension even between Europe and the United States, because the United States doesn't want these technologies and the Chinese industry footprint to take hold in Europe. So this is one piece of it. The U.S.-China competition really is going to characterize, I think, the broader global competition that we're seeing, because there's so much attached to it. When we talk about the global economy, it's not like during the Cold War, where you had Russia and the Soviet Union and the United States competing, and the Soviet economy, only about 5% of it was actually integrated with the broader economy of the world, right? The Western economies and the Soviet economies were pretty bifurcated. In comparison today, the Chinese economy is much more integrated within the global economy, and you can't just decouple and sort of turn that off. So this is something really, really important about, you know, how China and the United States are going to find their footing together. And there are so many disputes when you look at the South China Sea, when you look at the military footprint in the Asia Pacific region, when you look at Chinese maritime claims in the South China Sea, which have implications for global maritime commerce and transit, right? These are huge issues. When you talk about the issue of rare earth minerals in Africa, where we're seeing, you know, Russia and China have, you know, a very, very large footprint making investments in these countries. When you talk about organizations like BRICS that are emerging as perhaps a competitor, you know, to the West and to Western organizations. But again, looming over us still is the Ukraine war, is the chaos in the Middle East. You know, what we've seen, I think, and the important takeaway should be that we cannot afford to be short-sighted in international politics and geopolitics. And that's where a lot of our leaders, in my opinion, have really, really made some big mistakes, is they've prioritized short-term gains, largely to get reelected or largely to satisfy the interests of a constituency, rather than looking much more long-term at how their decisions are going to impact geopolitics, you know, over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. This is the critical time that we are living in right now. We have just crossed the threshold on January 1st of the first quarter century of the 21st century. So think about that. We've now gotten through 25 years of the 21st century. If we would have gone back to the year 2000 and we were thinking through, you know, what were the first 25 years looking like, looking into the future, I doubt many of us would understand where we are today. When you look at, we were thinking in the year 2000 that, you know, technology was going to save us, that, you know, that geopolitical competition was largely over, right? The great power competition was over. These were things coming out of serious think tanks and serious organizations, you know, governments were saying these things. Now we're looking at an age of unprecedented technological development, where we're going to look at the, you know, the rise of artificial intelligence, driving that competition, intensifying that competition. And so the AI race as well between the US and China is going to be another component of this competition that's heating up and that will drive, I think, the global strategic environment over the next 25 years.
Excellent, Asher, and thank you again, touching on AI a little bit here as well. Obviously, component of AI and cybersecurity as technology is advancing, as we're seeing also a lot of threats to US and also other parts of the world that is happening simultaneously with also these current issues that you addressed here. I'm curious, what would you suggest and recommend for leaders to change their perspective, how they're looking at? I'm glad you mentioned looking long-term strategies and implications that we cannot anymore do things that we were doing thus far. Obviously, it's a lot of opportunities to repair these relationships, but also to rebuild a trust that is lacking. I just returned from Europe and Pulse there on what's coming. It's very challenging just seeing from different points of view and perspective when how others see us and what their perspective is of U.S. politics as well as intentions. So do you mind sharing a little bit, how do you look at that combination of technology advancements and geopolitics together?
Absolutely. Let me take the first part of your question and just dive into the US and Europe for a comparative example. The US, I would argue, for the last maybe 20 years has really been struggling with its own identity in terms of what should America's role be in the world? Which role? And historically, America has seen itself as the shining city upon the hill. So you have this tension historically between the interventionists and global interventionists who believe that the US needs to be engaged everywhere, and you know, more of a inward looking, sort of more interest-based American foreign policy. So this tension between ideals and interests is gonna be there, I think, always in American foreign policy as we look at how the US engages. This idea of supporting democracy abroad, particularly by military intervention, this is a bad recipe for American foreign policy. We've seen this play out constantly over the last 25 years. And I think that's where a lot of current policymakers are now. They recognize that these were mistakes and we cannot make the same mistakes again. And so now with this recent election of President Trump, I think you're going to see a much more balanced foreign policy where the United States is going to be still the dominant global power militarily and economically. But the United States is going to ask different things of its partners. The United States is going to empower its European powers to take much more of their own futures in terms of their military investments much, much more seriously into their own hands. The Europeans themselves, I think, have recognized that what has led them to this point, which is an over-reliance largely on the American security umbrella, is no longer a viable way ahead. Europe has lagged far behind in terms of its own defense industrial base. It needs to reinvent that. It needs to reinvest in that if it wants to be able to maintain its position in the world. And also the European Union itself, the European governments, if you look at some of the policies they've enacted, the European Union, much like the United States, is going through some soul searching in terms of what is its role in the world, right? Are we going to, because if you think about this, the next step forward logically would be more of a common European defense, which would mean maybe some sort of a European army, a European defense force. That's been talked about, but no serious effort has really been made to put that together. There's much more emphasis on NATO as the security umbrella organization. And I would imagine that that is going to be the same, very much the same moving forward. We've already heard President Trump talking about perhaps asking for a 5% commitment in terms of defense spending of a country's entire GDP. That's a huge change from the current 2% threshold that the NATO countries are abiding by. Now we'll see if that actually materializes, or if this is President Trump essentially trying to set the conditions to make things much more advantageous as he begins his term and starts negotiating with his own NATO partners in Europe in terms of a way ahead. But you look at the immigration policies in Europe that have happened, you know, most notably under the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel. You look at a lot of the societal disruptions that have happened, where you're trying to integrate large groups of migrants from areas outside of Europe with much different customs, much different religions, much different societal values, and how this is creating tensions. And there's a blowback on European governments for doing this, because there are legitimate concerns that many, many Europeans have raised that, you know, I don't recognize my country anymore. How are we going to integrate groups that don't want to integrate, right? And this is an area that I think governments ignored, or they even demonized anybody who criticized, these policies. And now they're paying the price for that. And you look what's happening in Germany, You look at what's happening in France and other European countries, and we're seeing that clearly Europe is at this critical juncture as well, where it needs to make the European Union as an entity, and also individual European governments need to rethink some of these issues. So how the European and United States partnership moves forward is really important, because that's really the bulwark against what we're seeing materialize as this, you know, China-Russia relationship, along with Iran, North Korea, others. You know, one of the big things that in the 1970s, President Nixon was able to do was to drive a wedge in between Russia and China. Right now, what we're seeing is Russia and China moving closer together. So what policies is the United States, and what are its allies going to do to help try to break up this, this alliance, rather than pushing these countries closer together? How do we separate this out and try to find ways to cooperate?
A lot of very great points, and I'm sure that many of those will be discussed at upcoming World Forum, as many leaders around the globe are coming together. And I'm sure it's on top of my mind, not only just for them, but of every citizen of every nation, because we're seeing unprecedented, obviously, political changes, economical shifts, and things that really put people to think about it, where we are truly headed. So with that in mind, I'm curious, first of all, what do you see that we could improve here in the United States first, before we also share?
Well, I think a few things. Number one, what my sincere hope is moving forward is that the United States will enter a period in which some of these internal divisions that we've gone through these last, let's just say, 10 years, may dissipate. I'm not very optimistic that will happen, but we have to learn to talk to each other. We have to learn to tolerate people who have differing opinions, you know. And we'll see how that starts over these next few months as the new administration, you know, takes office. Are we going to see the same kinds of, you know, efforts to sort of demonize each other to the point where there is no motivation to move towards the middle? I hope that that's not the case. I think this is a real problem for American society, and it creates a problem more globally, because we've seen a lot of these kinds of divisions manifest themselves in other countries as well, and particularly in Europe. So this is something that I think we need to be able to do better at. We need to understand that people with whom we have maybe even very intense disagreements are still our friends, are still our fellow citizens. You know, they're our friends, they're our neighbors, they're our relatives in some cases. And we can have really intense debates. We ought to have spirited debates without demonizing or making these things personal to where people say, well, I don't even want to be in the same room with these other people. That's actually a corruption, I think, of democracy itself, which we need to really do a better job at. The second thing I would suggest, and this really applies across the globe, is we need to think differently and more in a more disciplined way about the future and about how multiple possible futures could emerge, so that when we make decisions, whether that's, you know, as individuals, as organizations, or as governments, that we are always thinking through this important question: and then what? This is the most important part of every decision that we need to ask ourselves. And then what? If I do this, what's going to happen next? And then think about mapping that out and understanding that we may have, you know, some significant outcomes that emerge from that one decision that we haven't necessarily connected. And there is a framework to do this. And this is why I've invested so much of my own academic research and professional efforts over the last years to developing this strategic foresight-based approach, to understand that there is a way to harness the uncertainty that is going to be part of all of our decisions. And rather than making that a liability, make it an advantage, right? Understand that we're not going to ever mitigate uncertainty, but we could say, look, we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. We don't know what the next 10 years, but do we know what that looks like? Do we know what we want it to look like? If we know what we want that end state to look like, then we can develop a plan to get there, and we can understand what are the sources of disruption that might stand in our way. And if we make a particular decision, what might some alternative future scenarios be, so that we can maybe see through that decision and say, okay, in scenario A, B, C, or D, who are the winners and losers? If we are not on the winning side of any of these scenarios, why is that? Is it because we decided not to decide? Is it because we didn't make an investment somewhere? Is it because we limited our options? Figure out exactly why that is, and then we can come back and see how our original decision might be impacted. I think this, you know, cascading basically from the executive level, from the, that, you know, highest executive level in governments on down, is just a better way to govern. It's a better way to make decisions. It's taking some best practices from industry, because let's be honest, right? Great ideas don't necessarily originate in government. In many cases, you know, governments are the problem, not necessarily the solution. So we need to have a much better public and private sector discourse. I mean, look, the United States is the envy of the world. This is the most innovative country in the world. Okay, we've got, you know, all of the, you know, the best and brightest minds. This is the biggest element of the United States soft power. If you ask anybody, you know, any young entrepreneur across the world, you know, where would you want to go to start your company? Hands down, they're going to say the United States. So we need to be careful. We need to make sure that we are good stewards of that, and we encourage that, and that we grow that ecosystem of entrepreneurs in the United States, so that we can keep our businesses moving forward and stay ahead. And this ties into your question about technology, so that we can maintain our technological edge as we look at making investments in things like quantum computing and artificial intelligence and all of these disruptive technologies that are going to put us in that position.
Love that. And I'm so glad you mentioned it, also how obviously opportunities that we can do internally before we also come in and influence things externally, specifically when we look at from those ideological influences and lessons from the history. And I love what you mentioned, because obviously everything has a cause and effect, right? And understanding what implications and playing things forward and knowing that every move or any decision also has a certain consequences, and are we aware of them, and obviously risks associated with that. So with that in mind, I'm just curious, obviously you are in preparation to publish your book, and you're working on the revenge of ideology. Could you mind walking us a little bit about how those ideas are shaping global order, and what some of the little preview of the upcoming book, please?
Thanks very much. Yeah, so I think the biggest reason why I decided to write this, and you know, to our earlier discussion points, is that we've got to better understand how the world fits together and look at some of the root causes of these key foreign policy issues before we can start to solve the problems. And in many instances, we end up in the United States immediately responding with a military hammer, you know, and if you're using a military hammer, right, you know, you're going to use all the military nails, and everything is going to become a very narrow focus, right? And my argument is that if you look at the way the world has developed and is developing now, and the competition, the great power competition that we're living through again, the multipolar competition, it's actually the world rebalancing to what is normal. It isn't normal in history to only have, you know, one power. One unipolar power, right? Or even to have, let's say, you know, a bipolar competition, right? We're seeing this multipolarity in the world, and that's a very important characteristic. But what's driving some of this? Why, for example, do countries do stupid things? Why do we look at policy decisions and we say, you know, to be very, very, you know, simplistic about this, you know, why are countries making decisions that are directly contrary to what we would look at as their rational self-interest? Well, this is what the book really looks at. It looks at this idea that ideas, right, still matter today, even in this age of advanced technologies, that ideas fundamentally are the drivers of change in international politics. And an ideology is not just something that's floating around in the air. It's not just something that you can't see or touch, but it's really an ideology. The way I define it in the book is really the way in which ideas become material, and how those material structures, how those structures actually create foreign policy decisions. And through the lens of an ideology, right, this living, breathing system, we actually may become lost in our own image and make strategic mistakes because we're unable to see the world as it is. We only see it as we want to see it through that narrow lens of ideology. So the book looks at the competition today, and it looks at China, and it looks at Russia, and it looks at Turkey as different examples where these ideological models are manifesting. So it starts with actually creating this new theory of what ideology is, looking at the actual material structure, basically a network. It's a network of the general population of a country, of socio-political elites, and also the control apparatuses of a state. So for example, think about, you know, the military forces, the educational system, communications, all these things together. So this becomes a network that sort of interacts with each other. And these networks exert influence in terms of how decisions are made on foreign policy. So for example, in China, it isn't that China is just a sort of a doctrinaire Marxist communist country. I argue that what China is actually living through now is something that's called Neo-Confucian communism, where you're actually seeing this ideological power network, these elements of Chinese society come together. And a lot of what the current ideological model is based on is actually a look towards ancient Chinese Confucianism mixed today with what we see as that communist ideology, because nobody in China today really is excited about doctrinaire Marxism, right? It's basically a capitalist, it's a controlled capitalist economy and an authoritarian regime. So how are you going to get the general population to go along with this? Well, you have to find something that unites everybody. And so that uniquely Chinese element is Confucianism. So it's Neo-Confucian communism. In Russia, I look at what I call Neo-Eurasian imperialism as the dominant ideology of the Russian regime. And if you look at that, this is a mix of Russia's historical greatness in terms of being an empire that is both Eurasian and Asian and European, destined to rule over that landmass, and also Orthodox Christianity, which very, very significantly impacts this ideological model in terms of the socio-political elites. And so if you look at the Ukraine war and other actions that Russia has taken, if you look at, for example, the fact that there is a schism today in Eastern Christianity between the Russian Orthodox Church and between the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch Bartholomew, if you look at that, that also is an element of this ideological struggle. And we could spend hours just talking about that issue and how that's manifested itself. So all of these issues together, and then you look at Turkey. The reason I use Turkey as an example is because it's a smaller country. It doesn't have the capacity to drive global events like Russia and China, but it's an important because it's a regional power. And if you look at what's happening in the Middle East today, Turkey has really transformed itself over the last 20 years that President Erdogan has been in power. And I argue that Turkey's ideological power network in the book is really something that's called Neo-Turkic autonomy, where you see Turkey becoming much, much more happy to look east as well as looking west, where it isn't necessarily going to be the same pro-Western democracy that we've seen in the past. But if you look at a lot of what's happened over the last 20 years in Turkey, where today, even the U.S.-Turkey relationship is so strained, you look at what's happening in Syria, you look at some of the comments just since October 7th, where we see Turkey actually being the main exporter of political Islam, a role that we previously saw Saudi Arabia take, and why President Erdogan, why this Neo-Turkic autonomy has such a religious undertone to it. This is an important element that we in the West have to understand, because a lot of our core security interests are intertwined in that. So to wrap this sort of up, I know there's a lot there that we covered, but the main premise of the book, and you'll have to read it to understand a lot more of the details of it, is just to see that we cannot understand some of the biggest global security issues today just by looking at material, looking at how many guns, how many bombs, how many missiles a country has. It's much deeper than that. It isn't just about resource competition, energy competition. It's about a war for ideas. And that war for ideas is very alive and well today, even in the United States, in our own national security strategy, the latest one that was published, we make no mention of ideology as even being a thing. And I think if we're going to understand the global security implications of the next 25 years, we have to do a better job of understanding the root causes. And so that's what I hope the small contribution will be, is to helping our policymakers do a better job of understanding what that is.
I love that, and I can't agree more, because we can't continue fixing things just on the surface without understanding the root causes. and obviously being reactive to things. So I love the approach and depth of that, and I cannot wait to read the book. So on that note, do you mind just sharing a little bit of the real examples where you kind of see this really happening simultaneously, where we have opportunities to see specific strategic foresight or technological elements played out as a crucial role in the shaping on those government levels, decision-making, and better as a result outcomes?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think there are so many opportunities for this to happen. First of all, we'll start with the technology aspect that we've talked about. We've seen that clearly, you know, developing technology is not, this isn't just today. I mean, this is, you know, going back, you know, over 100 years, that the technological advancement has to be part of our national security agenda. And that today, perhaps more important than ever, is this public-private sector collaborative framework that we have to have, where we have universities in this ecosystem, researchers, and industry. You know, industry needs to be given more incentive, right? That means that the government needs to, frankly, get out of the way in many cases and not be, you know, not over-regulate a lot of these things that we're seeing. I mean, this is the big problem I view today in Europe, is that, you know, Europe is just over-regulating itself to death. And this is perhaps, you know, if I were advising European governments, it's that if you want to stay competitive in the future, you've got to do a much better job of understanding that, you know, businesses, industries, you know, need to be able to fail forward. Entrepreneurs need to be able to fail forward. Failure is not a, you know, a zero sum game where that's it. You fail once and you're done. I mean, look at what's happening. Look at the culture of Silicon Valley, where failure is seen as something to be actually learned from, and people get other chances to do other things. That's really, really important. One way you can do this from a policy perspective is what I talked about earlier, which is adapting a more flexible mentality and integrating futures thinking into your processes, so that you're not moving forward from sort of a point A to point B to point C along a linear approach, but that you're recognizing that the world we live in today is so complex that there's this interconnectivity that we're living through today, that you have to have a much more flexible approach to decision making. And that's what foresight can give you. It can help you, it can take a good strategy and make it a great strategy. And this goes from, like I said, I mean, I've done this in advising, you know, other governments or industries or businesses. It's scalable. So number one, you have to have leadership that is willing to accept some of these lessons and then ask the right questions. So you have to have a culture that's built around this, which fosters more of this back and forth. You have to have leaders that have a demand signal to ask for these kinds of products. And then you also have to have a workforce that understands, you know, what it is that it can do and provide, and its limitations and advantages. So I think that's really, really important. On the more geopolitical sort of global level, where I think we're going to have to start seeing more of a convergence is, you know, what does this competition look like over the next 5 to 10, 15 years? Is this more, is it going to be sort of an entrenchment where we see these fault lines even you know, deeper between, you know, the West and China and Russia? Is there going to be room for opportunity? I think that there is room for some sort of a normalization of relations between Russia and Europe moving forward, but we're a long ways away from that, make no mistake. But I think that has to be the bigger strategic vision, which, you know, if we say that today, it may sound a bit ridiculous. But again, you know, 20 or 25 years from now, it may turn out to be that is actually, you know, what was a game changer in terms of breaking up this Russia-China relationship. And we also have to be very careful about, you know, being too eager to use military options as sort of the go-to in the United States. Let's also be clear. We've seen, in my opinion, that when the United States disengages from the world, or is not, there's not a credible deterrent, bad things happen. We've seen that from the catastrophic withdrawal from Afghanistan to what's happening now in Ukraine to a lot of the chaos in the Middle East. And already, I think we're seeing that with the new administration coming in, there is a perception of, we don't know exactly, there's an unpredictability about what President Trump might do. And I think that actually works to America's foreign policy as a big advantage. Now, we'll see exactly how all this plays out moving forward. But again, in the United States, is this the beginning of, you know, maybe 8 years of, you know, more of sort of a rightward shift in American politics? That also would drive global developments. So if we look at what happens after President Trump's term is done in 2028, and maybe his successor takes over, whoever that's going to be, what does that do? Does that, you know, drive competition, you know, further in this entrenchment? So I think all of these things together are going to be really important for us to be watching moving forward. But no matter what side of the equation we're on, I think this idea of having a capacity to think very, very deliberately about the future and understand that, you know, nothing is permanent, things are always in flux, and then we always have to come back to that question, and then what, as we make our decisions moving forward, I think that's going to be key, regardless of where we sit.
Thank you again for that great overview. Obviously, seems like we have chess game playing on a lot of different fronts and a lot of moves and a lot of things to pay close attention to. But I love also that obviously we have a great opportunities and we can much more collectively strive for a great outcomes, as you said, when we have a better foresight, when we have a better understanding, and also look at the long-term strategic approaches. With that in mind, in closing, I would love to just, if you can tell us from your perspective and everything that you share, and everybody that's watching and listening, I'm sure are eager to hear, what would you recommend or be give us advice for the leaders, obviously, that are looking right now, what they should be focusing as the next steps. We're obviously, as I mentioned, we have a World Economic Forum coming up very shortly. We have a lot of things happening here with in the United States. Month of January is going to be very hectic and a lot of movements. And if you could just pick one message or one piece of advice, what that would be.
Well, that's a really fascinating question. And there's so many different challenges that we have in front of us at this moment in time. And so sitting here in January of 2025, if we're talking about the United States, which I think is what you're asking, is, you know, number one, I think the most important issue above all else is going to be how to continue to grow the economy. You know, this is the most important piece of maintaining America's position in the world, and you know, getting. I think the United States needs to start understanding how to, if it's possible at this point, to try to get its you know, budget deficits under control. I think this is really, really important. And you know, and there's a lot of different thoughts about how to do that. But I think what we're seeing here is, you know, sort of unchecked spending without subsequent growth is not necessarily the way to go. So I think that that's really, really important. At the same time, I think also we've got to be really smart about how we engage with the world. I think we want to be the hub of and you know, where we have partners, you know, spokes, where we can be, you know, maintaining this security paradigm of guaranteeing global security, but at a way that empowers our partners, so that the burden on the United States is shared in a different way. I think that the American public understands that maintaining the United States global military dominance everywhere, all the time, at any cost is not necessarily feasible because of all of those implications that it comes with it. So we have to make some hard decisions as Americans about what that looks like. But I think maybe on a more positive note, and maybe to close with, it's that we have to understand that, you know, with good education, right, and understanding how we can use futures literacy to drive us to this potential that we have in this country and beyond, is really something that can put us in the driver's seat. It's really something that can catapult us forward. And when we see government, industry, the private sector, universities, you know, working together, and frankly, when we can bring our society together, rather than focusing on the divisions that we have, that's really something that I think is a force multiplier that is almost, you know, you almost can't calculate the value of it. And so that's going to be the biggest challenge. And I would say that, if we can all look at a future where we all see we have an important stake, both as Americans and global citizens, I think that's an important way to start looking at what the challenges mean for us moving forward, and that together, these challenges may not seem so daunting if we have this unified way forward.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. And for everybody that's watching and listening, where can they get in touch with you and learn more about your book and also opportunities that they like to explore?
Yeah, absolutely. The best place to go is to my website, which is www.jakesotiriadis.com. And there you'll find all sorts of updates, articles.
Thank you for listening to Legacy Leader Show. If you enjoyed the content and had a positive experience, then please leave us a positive rating. In addition, leave us a positive review whenever you are listening on whatever platform there might be. Make sure your friends and family also know about the benefit and value that we provide and what we have to offer. Cheers.